This is China Business Cast, your guide to doing business in the Wild Wild East. We're here to get detailed and get personal with experienced entrepreneurs making things happen in China. If you want to learn from on-the-ground accounts of how business actually gets done, this is the program for you. Hello and welcome to China Business Cast. I'm your host, JP. Well, actually, we're changing things up a bit this week. I've been down with a cold, so I haven't been able to record any interviews. Luckily, we got a special guest host for this episode. Our guest host is Ray Ma, the Greater China Venture Partner for 500 Startups. She'll be interviewing Steve Mushiro in this episode of China Business Cast. Steve is the co-founder and CEO of China NetCloud, China's largest internet-managed services company. Steve moved to China in 2005 after spending over a decade in Silicon Valley, where he worked as the CTO of a variety of technology startups. Before founding China NetCloud, Steve was the CTO of Tudou, one of China's largest video sharing websites. In this episode, Steve discusses some of the challenges of running a technology startup in Shanghai, as well as the overall environment for tech startups in China compared to that of Silicon Valley. Hope you enjoy it. Here we go.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ray.
Could you introduce yourself a little bit and also China NetCloud?
Sure. Well, my name is Steve Mushiro, and I'm here in Shanghai, China. And I don't know how far back you want to go. I'm American.
Yeah. And when did you arrive in Shanghai?
I first came to China actually over 20 years ago. I started visiting when I was going to school in Japan, but I officially moved to China, or more or less moved to China about 8 years ago in 2005. It was still partially Wild West and partially not Wild West, and it's been interesting to watch since then.
Okay. Before that, let's talk about China NetCloud really fast. Can you introduce China NetCloud services?
Sure. So we are China and probably the world's largest internet server operations company. And our job really is to run the back-end infrastructure, system servers for internet companies, games, mobile applications, and so on. So today we're mostly China-focused, so we're helping run large systems here, and eventually we'll do all over Asia, Southeast Asia, the US, and the rest of the world. But we really either build and then manage, or we got take over and optimize and manage back-end server infrastructure for sort of large-scale systems. So if you have 100 users or 1,000 users, it's really not that interesting. Sort of million-user systems are interesting. We have several customers with hundreds of millions of users. So those are all sexy and kind of cool.
Cool. And when did you start China NetCloud?
We started in 2008, so just about 5 years ago. Before that, I was CTO of Tudou, the video company here in China. So at the time, we were very similar to YouTube, and at that time, we were larger than YouTube.
Right.
So we were probably the world's largest video company at the time. And I was one of the world's largest bandwidth buyers, and so we were doing 100 million videos a day. Especially in China, it's different because at that time, even today in the US, videos, YouTube stuff tends to be short videos. Look at how cute my cat is. Or promotional videos, or like 3 or 4 minutes. We essentially were doing TV and movies. So it was multi-hour, American TV, European TV, Chinese, whatever. So it was almost like being a TV station and really running all this stuff. So much, much larger systems, bandwidth and all that than sort of a YouTube world. Since then, YouTube's grown much bigger, but it was very interesting at the time.
Was Tudou the first company that you joined once you came to Shanghai?
It was the first full-time company. Before that, I had done a bunch of consulting. So I was in Silicon Valley before this, so I moved here from Palo Alto. So I was sort of working there and here, consulting for different types of companies. So I did a bunch of technical stuff with Tudou, actually, but also 51.com and some other companies that were sort of here doing social networking, doing dating, doing blogs, doing all these types of things. So I've done some work with Chinese companies, but never worked inside of one, which was an interesting experience.
Because you just basically started your own.
Well, I went to Tudou first. So I sort of was here consulting with a lot of people and then joined Tudou full-time in 2007. So I was the first foreigner in a Chinese, rapidly growing, large-scale tech company. I didn't speak Chinese that well, and I was sort of new in a lot of ways. That was very colorful.
How big was Tudou when you joined him versus when you left?
There were about 35 people or so when I started working with them and about 350 when I left.
Oh my gosh,
a little over a year.
Wow.
And a lot of that was in sales, but a lot of it was just core engineering and everything else. So I was part of the first sort of group of VPs and sort of more senior people brought in, sort of grow the company. So it changed a lot and it's very interesting.
Right, and they're still next door.
Well, and then at the time we were, they were a different part of the city.
Oh, okay.
And so people, listeners can't see where we are, but they used to be across the city.
Okay.
And then I left in 2008 and we started this company here and moved into this little complex. And a year later, they moved in next to us. So all the office buildings in a city of 20 million people,
wow,
they essentially moved in literally next to us.
Right, because the whole time I thought that's, you know, that's why you picked this office.
No,
space,
no.
Because Trudeau was already there. But
they were on Suzhou Creek.
Oh,
and
okay,
we came here because this office belonged to one of our customers.
Oh,
so
okay,
one of our first customers had this and they had extra space. Mm-hmm. And so my partner and I and one of our assistants moved in. So there was three of us and 25 people at the customer.
Mm-hmm.
A year later, there were 25 of us and three of the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of got smaller and eventually went away. And we've since eaten the whole office. But
yeah,
but no, we were here just luck of finding the right place. And as you can see, we walked in. This is, you know, a lot of offices in China, especially 5-6 years ago or more, even when Trudeau started, you know, start in really sort of crappy circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Not so common anymore, but certainly back then, early 2000s, to start in apartments,
yes,
you know, and sleep there, right?
Right?
So you have like 10 engineers all sleeping in the same rooms, which smells great, and, you know, cranking out code in the living room and just sort of living there. It's low,
yeah,
cost, right? You see that in San Francisco a little bit in the old loft days, but
mm-hmm,
really sort of doing it that way. That's not so common anymore. But, you know, startups usually can't afford decent offices, and here they kind of tend to be end up in crappy places. So we got really lucky here with, you know, wood floors and sort of old industrial building and ceiling. This actually is a creative space, whatever that means. This building actually is owned by the city. And,
okay,
and somewhat surprising, we have, they're a really good landlord. Like, things break, they come fix it, which is kind of amazing in China because you don't see that, you know, so often. So anyway, so we inherited this from one of our customers.
So you started this company in 2008.
2008, yes.
And so now we're in 2013. How many people do you have now?
We have about 75 people.
Wow.
So mostly full-time and then a whole lot of interns.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been a huge fan of using interns,
mm-hmm,
even in the U.S. There's obviously low-cost ways to do things. And, you know, in China, interns are a different world somewhat, but there are a lot of things it doesn't pay to automate. You know, if you automate something, you have to hire somebody really expensive to write code versus, mm-hmm, you can just give it to somebody who's maybe not so expensive. You can get an intern, you know, English speaking, essentially full time, because fourth year university kids here don't go to school.
Right.
Full time intern for maybe $300 a month, maybe $250 a month.
Wow.
Yeah, English speaking now, you get what you pay for sometimes. But you can get a lot of interesting things. Then we have Russian interns, we have French interns, we have all kinds of people. But anyway, so we have about 75 people, probably about 20 interns.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear for me as a shareholder. That you're controlling costs. So
controlling costs, yes. We've been extremely miserly with cost. We fortunately inherited all the furniture and most of the stuff in the office. We've slowly upgraded. We buy 5 chairs a month and, you know, slowly improve things. But
So can you tell us about basically how did you come up with the idea for ChinaNet Cloud, and also specifically how did you find your, you know, founding team, James?
Yeah, so I actually met James early on, you know, when I first came here. Actually, one of the first times I came to China, I was out at an American Chamber of Commerce event that they used to have here, you know, networking, mixer kind of stuff. And obviously, I'm trying to meet people and network and all that, same as you would in the Valley. So I'm at this event. I wasn't going to go, but I had nothing else to do, so I went. And so I finally went there, and I'm randomly talking to people, and I end up meeting James. And he had just moved here from Japan. And I used to live in Japan, so we're chatting about Japan. He used to do insurance systems and that kind of stuff. So we're chatting about Japan insurance and all that, and you know, exchange cards and so on. Clap after that, and actually at the same event, about an hour later, I ended up meeting my future wife. So I met James for my partner James and my wife.
Auspicious day.
In the same day, yes, so that's September 28th. And it's good I met him in that order. Otherwise, I'd be married to him and have business with her. Maybe, I don't know. But so yes, that was a good day. And so then James and I just kept in touch, having beers, you know, catching up from time to time. He was at Bearing Point at the time, management consulting. But we were both sort of lamenting the same problems that I saw at Trudeau and he saw also, where, you know, this is China and sort of booming IT sector, booming internet businesses. This is the world's largest internet. You know, we now have 600 million people, you know, double the population of the U.S. online every day. And yet not enough engineers, not enough expertise. And China has a shortage of almost every profession, you know, whether it's people to run the internet, whether it's people to make coffee, people to check you into a hotel, lawyers, everything is shortage because it's so new and the place is booming. And so here I was at Trudeau, you know, very famous, lots of money, and yet we couldn't find anybody to help us really run the systems. You know, all the engineers are very young, very inexperienced, and it wasn't a salary issue. This didn't exist. And James was finding the same thing, dealing with corporate systems. So we decided to start China NetCloud really to solve that problem, which was really how do you outsource and help companies solve these issues, provide world-class talent, world-class expertise, you know, and all the details, configuration, security, performance, reliability, all these things that everybody needs, might be really hard to find. And also, the internet has evolved in China. You know, to some extent, it's behind the West by a number of years, probably still is. And so at that time, it was really, you know, video like Trudeau, it was blogs, it was kind of news. So you're not that serious, really. If you lose a few blogs or something doesn't work, that's not that important. But now, of course, it's evolved much like the West into e-commerce, into advertising, into travel, into all these things, which have much higher economic impact. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if your video site's down for an hour, not a big deal. But if you can't buy something or can't travel or can't do whatever, much more serious. So the economic issues are much higher. Right. And yet, not enough people to do things. So now, in the last couple of years, we've had, you know, iPhone and apps and Android, mobile phones. So a huge explosion in that, just like in the West. So the amount of infrastructure required to sort of run all this is just massive. And so we're here to build and run it all.
Wow, okay. But how did you convince James, for example, join in, or was it just mutual? Like,
yeah, it was kind of mutual.
Solve the problem.
Yeah, it was mutual. We both complained about the same thing, and I was thinking about leaving Trudeau and kind of do something new in a startup, and he was doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Kind of, he'd been doing corporate, management consulting and so on for many years, in the U.S. and Japan and here. And that also gets tiring after a while. I'm looking to do something new and do something entrepreneurial. James had worked in an early stage startup in the Valley a number of years ago, and he was one of the early guys in. And I think missed that also excitement of doing things in a startup versus in a little big company. Mm-hmm. Plus, not only is he in a big company, his customers are big companies. So it's all big bureaucratic, you know, Chinese banks and these kind of things. And, you know, that's different than being on the internet, which is really the Wild West, especially in China. Because things move fast, you know, in the Valley, in the U.S., but things here are even faster. You know, things change quicker. Nobody tests anything. Everything's just thrown at the wall. So it's the Wild West is very appropriate as a term.
Right. And you have more of a technical background, and James had more of a business background, would you say?
Correct. He has a technical background also, but I definitely have much more tech background. And therefore, he focuses more on sales. So he's always, even prior job was much more sales, customer focused, out managing, you know, relationships and, you know, partnerships and all these types of things.
Right.
So he's always handled that part of the business while I focus on the back end and systems and services and all of that.
Do you guys have a local Chinese partner or a local sort of Chinese founding employee? Because it's just the two of you as co-founders, right?
Correct. Yeah, we don't. And
was there any attempt to try to find a local Chinese partner?
There was, not initially, but early, like, sort of a year later, we looked somewhat, and we're still looking, actually. We're very lucky now we'll bring in a partner, maybe too strong a word, but a sort of GM, especially for China, because eventually we're building a global business. Mm-hmm. So even though we're based in China today, our eventual vision is to take over the whole world, maybe Mars also. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be a China, you know, China's of course our biggest business today, but eventually there'll be a focus or someone to focus just on that while we also handle other places, the US and so on. So probably the path in the future will be to bring in someone sort of look after this. But so yeah, we looked somewhat and to find someone, particularly for the sales side. And then, you know, we're a small company and not be able to afford a lot, it's hard to get the right person and recruiting and so on. So it sort of has never gotten done.
Never gotten. Do you feel like that's negatively impacted your business?
I think so. In the sense that our largest challenge today and all along has been building and managing our sales force. Mm-hmm. And there's many reasons for that, especially in China. But one of the reasons, of course, is we're foreigners with relatively limited sales experience ourselves. In sales management, and of course, cross culture and local teams. And as you can imagine, things sometimes are sold differently here and in different ways. And so that's been a real challenge. And like I said, a lot of professions are scarce here. And sales is one of the sort of top of that list. All my friends, everyone I talk to, is always, you know, do you have any good sales guys? You know, or I just fired my one guy. Just like, I just fired my whole sales team for the third time. You know, and this guy's been here 20 years. You know, and just, you know, trying to do something new. And people, you know, jump ship all the time and all that. So it's a significant challenge in the environment and market. And we've done many different things and so on. So I think, yeah, having a local partner probably would have made that smoother and easier. And it's one of the reasons we're also still looking. But you still have to keep going and get started and do stuff. So you can't sort of look around too much if there's nobody sort of around, so to have recruiters and so on to go get them now.
Right. Other than sort of human resource challenges, both from your time at, you know, Tudo and now China NetCloud, what are some of the challenges otherwise you've faced in China in a business context?
Yeah.
Or in a personal context, if you want to share.
Right. I would say 80-90% of it's human resource.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
I mean, I think China is an interesting place. Depends how you approach it. Mm-hmm. You know, and people coming for many reasons and many different ways and many different segments. You know, there's people here that are just very short term. They're here for a project a year or two and they leave and they sort of live out in the foreigner sections and never really run into Chinese people, go to Starbucks every day and all this. They're not really in China. But then there's sort of the long term people that are here more like any place, you know, more than 5 years seems to be the limit, 5 or 10 years, who sort of maybe love China is too strong a word, but, you know, are used to it, like it here, a lot of different things. There's a lot to like. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's in many ways much, much easier to live here than a lot of places. And so if you have the right mindset, you know, same thing, but also a lot of people hate it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, why am I here? Oh, it's so busy and crowded and dirty and all these things. And I'm like, are we in the same city? But so somewhat it depends on your perspective a lot. Like, mm-hmm. if you're willing to put up with the stuff, right, the issues. I'm sure it's the same as living in New York City. There's a lot to love about that, a lot to hate about it. Mm-hmm. And how you approach it really defines, I think, what you're going to think about it. I think that's here, too. And so... a lot of things are just, China's a lot, you know, a lot of people think that it's a hard place to do business. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you're not Chinese, you don't speak the language, the culture, how to sell, guanxi, yeah. the mm-hmm. you know, money you got to pay everybody, all this kind of stuff. I don't think that's really true, I think. And there actually were a lot of foreigners here that are running very large and very successful businesses, not always that visible. Mm-hmm. And it isn't as hard as people make it out to be, if you have the right perspective. There's a million little problems. Mm-hmm. How many of them are China-specific, especially outside the HR? I think not so much. But the HR challenges of finding good people, keeping them, motivating them, so on, is pretty significant. But, you know, and we're in Shanghai. And Shanghai is not, you know, third-tier cities in the middle of nowhere, which is a whole different world. And, you know, in many ways, to me, China is like the U.S. 100 years ago. So when I was living in the U.S. 100 years ago, it was different. But it really is. So you think of the U.S. at the end of the 19th century, it was still very regionalized. We were just getting the railroads, the roads, electricity was new. Newspapers were just becoming national. People still spoke a lot of different languages. Mm-hmm. You know, Shanghai or China is really like that too. It's just in the last 10 years are all these things coming together and sort of new industries sprouting up and all this new stuff. And so you made the same problems. In the U.S., we forget we had these problems too, you know, with tainted milk and all that. We think that's a Chinese thing. Well, we had the same issues. But if you think of it in that context, you know, it's still a very diverse place where there's, you know, the New York, Shanghai's kind of the New York of China. And New York 100 years ago was a very cosmopolitan, very busy, very, you know, Wall Street-y, very money place. And maybe Kansas, Alabama, these places weren't so much. And that big gap, right? You imagine dropping into Alabama 100 years ago or Mississippi. Same thing now here, right? You drop into the same kind of places. They're really rural and really different and really cultural language, everything different. China still has that, which probably makes it exciting because it's not all homogenized. You can argue the U.S. has become homogenized in a lot of ways. China, not so much. But speaking as working in here in Shanghai, you know, it's faster and quicker to start a business here than it is in New York.
Really?
You know, and there's much less regulated. It's not so easy for foreigners, but for Chinese, mm-hmm. you know, a day. You know, and to get license, to get power, to get a phone, to get, you know, I can get faster internet and more phone lines in this room than I can get in San Francisco, you know, and I can get it quicker.
Are you sure
yes,
about that?
Yes, I'm sure.
Wow. You know, okay. Well, I can get,
it's expensive.
Okay.
But I can get gig ethernet to this room probably tomorrow, you know, wow. or certainly next week. I can have this room filled to the ceiling with servers in the next hour if I really needed to do that. And certainly by tomorrow. You can't do that in California. And phone lines. So I lost that. Something. I'm not even bribing anybody. It's just, you know, things here can move very quickly and are very flexible in some ways. And, you know, some stuff bureaucratic and so on. But it's actually pretty efficient. All of our taxes, the business annoyances that I think cause people a lot of headaches in places like India or mm-hmm. the Philippines or mm-hmm. Vietnam, where there's just all this bureaucracy and all these nightmare leaks that I hear about are not nearly as a problem here. I mean, we pay Social Security and taxes and all this business nightmare kind of stuff, finally, same, easier than California by a lot. And so all that kind of stuff you think would normally be a huge annoyance, make business so hard here, I don't think really is. And so it's really back to the HR thing of how do you find people, you know, China grad talent at every level. And it's a weird place because people that aren't here, you know, education's a big issue, of course, Chinese culture-wise. And also here, so you know, even the girl that works the front desk has a four-year degree. And there's a certain split in society about those that have degrees and those that don't. It's much more pronounced, I think, than the rest of the world. But those two-year degrees aren't really the same as they might be elsewhere. It's more like a community college or even a high school kind of thing. And so, you know, China graduates, I think it's like 7 million or something. New graduates every year, that sounds too low. But, or 70 million, a large number. And, you know, they can't find jobs. And it's hard. There's a whole sort of dynamics in the culture and parents and salaries and all that that actually make it fairly difficult to find good people. And then once you have them, to motivate them and keep them, because everybody wants to work for a big company, everybody wants stability. And there's a lot of complexity to that. You know, in Shanghai, the pressure, I'm glad I'm not Chinese, actually, in a lot of ways, or young Chinese, because if you're a Chinese guy, Shanghainese man,
right.
You're 22, you just graduated, right?
Uh-huh.
Maybe you're 25, many of our engineers. You know, we pay, so a new engineer at that age, engineer now, this is technical guy, right?
Right.
We're paying, getting a little bit higher now, maybe $750 a month.
Uh-huh. For a new grad?
For a new grad, yeah.
No experience?
No experience. A little bit of experience, maybe somewhat, you know.
Okay.
Up to maybe double that. So $1,000 a month is actually a pretty good salary. Mm-hmm. This is $10,000, $12,000 a year, right? With
right.
fairly significant taxes on this. And that's great. And that's not so bad. Most of them live at home if they're Shanghainese. So you can make okay. The problem is no girl is going to marry you or even date you unless you own a house or an apartment or a condo and a car.
Right.
So downtown Shanghai prices are at least as expensive as San Francisco.
Right.
So, you know, it's $1 million for anything decently nice, $500,000 for almost anything, dollars now, that you'd want to live in outside somewhere. So you make $10,000 a year. Oh, by the way, it's 20, 30, 40% down payment. There's no 0% down payment here. There's no none of this U.S. style stuff. So, you know, you want a house, you're going to come up with several $100,000 to start on your $10,000 a year salary. So you can imagine the stress. It also explains some of the under the table things that happen, but the stress and pressure to move up, to make money, because literally a girl will not date you and you have no hope of getting married in the, say that 10 year window that you have to sort of do this, you know? And so this is very, so people marry girls from outside and whatever, and you can say a lot about Shanghai culture and all this and money, but there's some of the realities on the ground. And so make it very challenging and complex to keep people and have them interested in where they can go, and they want stability, stable work.
But why don't
India has the same problem so much.
Just adjust upwards then?
Because there's 5 or 10 million of these guys graduating every year and not enough jobs for them. And not enough, you know. It is surprising that given the shortage of so many professions, there's not more wage pressure. Certainly salaries are going up, but probably up 50% in the last 5 years and what we have to pay for people.
But that's not a lot, 50% over 5 years compared to the inflation.
Exactly. Inflation's probably even worse and compared to still how low the numbers are. It's still $10,000 a year buys any new graduate in any profession. And as low as half that. I mean, some top schools maybe not, but, you know, we can get people for half that, you know, $5,000 a year or $6,000 a year if you don't have much experience. And so, yeah, people can live on that barely, but it's still a very low wage in that sense. And yeah, you can imagine some of the differences. Because the reality is, what happens is their parents help them,
right?
And friends and family and Guanxi and a lot of other dynamics that are at work in the Chinese environment. And you know, people walking around brand new iPhones everywhere. You know, they cost 2 months' salary. So it's a very interesting place. Dynamically, but yeah, so it's hard to find good people, and then even those that are more experienced, you know, it's still somewhat a hierarchical or experience-based culture. The older you are, so the more senior you are, and so on. So, you know, if someone's been, say, they're 30 years old, 35 years old, then now they want to be paid sort of triple that or quadruple that, whether they have the experience or not. It's like, oh, well, I'm 35, you should pay me, you know, $2,000 a month or three. So it creates a lot of these conundrums where people are sort of unemployable. And that's, I think, becoming worse because the demands are getting higher. You know, the demands for English and a lot of work is, you know, becoming more important because of, you know, international business and all this kind of stuff. And just interesting dynamic we're going to see over the next few years. But
Well, given all those challenges, would you still sort of recommend, you know, someone who wants to start a business, who wants to be an internet or mobile internet entrepreneur, to come to China? And do you see any opportunity for them, especially if they're not local Chinese and don't speak the language and, you know, are not familiar with the culture?
Right. So my general answer always is yes. Just come to China anyway. Right? It's still inexpensive to be here. There's still so much
growth.
Go east, young man. Go to the far east, young man. There's still so much going on here. I think, though, that I did hear a quote recently, and I forgot who told me this. Maybe it was you, actually. About one difference, though, is if you want to be here, a lot of stuff's already been done. And this is still a very developed country in a lot of ways. If you really want to make a huge impact and really, really be in the Wild West and out sort of foraging over the hills with the covered wagons, then maybe you're better off in Vietnam or Cambodia or Myanmar or the Burma, that kind of stuff, because that's where the real frontiers are. You can be the only guy or the only girl, you know, in a village or in a province that's doing something. So you want to be the mobile phone operator or the, you know, farm management guy, you know, and doing, and India has some opportunities too. This is not the place, because this is, you know, a huge billion person country and with super fast trains and all this kind of stuff. So the dynamics are different. And so it depends what you want, but because you go there, there's no power, no water. You're living, you know, sort of the missionary sort of life. And so it depends what you're interested in. And you can make different impact. I think you can make more, you probably can make more social impact and more of these type of things in those places. Make money, I'm not sure. But here there's still a huge opportunity to do lots of stuff. And there's a lot of, you know, foreigners. Obviously, you sort of ought to like China and you ought to have some interest in it. And you ought to have some, you know, something that drives you more than just money, but adventure and lots of things. And you can live pretty cheaply here. So it's just a lot of, you know, I think if you are just doing interesting things, a lot to be done here. And to me, at least, one of the reasons I came originally is, you know, even if you've been here a while, whatever, do something, wherever you go on to next, having been here is valuable, especially if you haven't worked outside the U.S. or outside of Europe or whatever. There's just so much in the world to see and so on. So the more international, the more, you know, the sort of mid-level country here, valuable. Obviously, if you can speak Chinese over time, that's useful because China is really important over the world. So even if you go from here to Vietnam, if you can speak Chinese, that's useful in Vietnam too. Mm-hmm. And it's useful in Africa, and it's useful in California, you know. So same as if you can speak Japanese or Arabic or Spanish, you know, all these things are super useful for the rest of your life. Where if you stay in the U.S., it's hard to get those things, you know, other than Spanish maybe. So yeah, absolutely. If someone has the opportunity, my still advice is leave tomorrow.
So there is no circumstance in which you would say, no, you should think about it.
Well, I think it depends on the situation. I mean, you know, if you're married and have kids, and it's more economic, like what are the dynamics of getting here?
Opportunity costs.
Yeah, putting your kids in private schools here are not cheap. You know, it's $25,000 a kid a year in better schools. You can go to free in a Chinese school, but not if they don't speak Chinese. I mean, there are, you know, practical matters, but and career-wise, but you know, almost every career you can do is here. It doesn't pay as much. I mean, you take an economic hit to come here for sure. Mm-hmm. The days of a lot of expats being posted here in hardship position, everything being paid for, is not so much. Because the only guys that ever did that were really the big industrial companies, the car companies, the plane companies. Boeing probably still does this, GM, but and the lawyers and stuff, but not as much. If you're a young person, it's pretty much on your own dime. You got to kind of get your own butt over here. But you see new people here all the time. We hire all kinds of interns and people that are, you know, been here a week, a month, a year. just off, literally our FOB off the boat, right? Know people and they're here by a lot. We just had a recruiting conference for foreigners, about 2 weeks ago. It's like 1,000 people there. And they're all sort of 20-something looking for stuff. A lot of teaching English opportunities, still a lot of that. And good money there too. In fact, we struggle. It's a problem for us hiring Americans and native English speakers because we compete with the schools. And the schools will pay under the table usually, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, which is a good income here for native English speakers who can teach at all. And you can live even more richly out in the countryside doing this. You can make half that and live like a king in a villa if you want. So, you know, that's not, knowing nothing, 22 years old, right? I mean, this is pretty good. So there's lots of opportunities depending on what you're interested in and doing different things. And so, but it sucks a little bit because we want to hire Americans, you know, like maybe recent grads that can help us in a bunch of areas. We sort of have to pay because they're like, they'll pay me, you know, $3,000-$4,000 a month out of the table to go teach English at some big school. It's hard for me to do that. because they're not worth it.
What's the split between your foreigner and sort of local Chinese employee?
We're about probably 15% foreigner now, depending on how you count it, our full time. That's increasing actually as we do more international stuff, as we work with larger companies. We do a lot of business with customers coming from Europe and the US into China. And so obviously working with them in English and sort of Western project management and this stuff, so a foreign experience tends to work. But we also have a lot of return needs. We just hired a woman, just graduated from Oxford, you know, in England. Other ones that come back from the States. So it's a whole mix. But some companies here are all foreigners, some are no foreigners. It depends. Fortunately, it's really easy to get a visa here. So, you know, dealing with that sort of H-1B type visa is pretty straightforward. So we can sponsor a lot of people, so that works.
You were just in California, right? You were just in California, Silicon Valley, right? For a couple of weeks?
I was actually in Maine. In the,
oh, you were in
on
Maine.
East Coast,
okay.
Yeah. I'll be in Silicon Valley in a couple of, in a month.
Okay. Well, you've been to Silicon Valley very recently.
Yeah.
Right. So could you compare and contrast for me sort of the entrepreneurial and startup culture in and just the general state of the ecosystem between Silicon Valley and Shanghai specifically?
Sure. It's hard in some sense because I'm a Silicon Valley guy and I'm a huge proponent of Silicon Valley just in general. And I think people that, you know, think the Silicon Valley is either not important or is becoming less important or the rest of the world's taking it over. And, you know, you can be other kind of places and all these other innovation around the world.
Well, you say people, you mean people in Shanghai?
No, no, just anywhere, just anywhere. There's a sort of feeling of well, Silicon Valley isn't that important, it's on a decline. You know, innovation's happening in China and Europe and all these other zillion places. My general bias is they're full of crap. You know, is that Silicon Valley is more and more important, regardless of what anybody says. I think there is innovation, all these great things happening everywhere else, but it's still happening far faster and more in the Valley and almost accelerating, it would be my personal opinion. So with that bias, I would say that...
Noted.
So it's hard for people to compare themselves to Silicon Valley because, you know, it's decades of all these things that make the Valley great in a lot of ways. And some of those don't transfer as well. And so part of the challenge here in China, and I think Beijing and Shanghai, is that pretty vibrant startup cultures, but still very small. And the things that you need to be really successful, which is, you know, partially the incubators, but also just all the interaction and all the service providers and all the events and all the cross-learning is not really here. And one of the biggest problems that I think it really is a challenge is that you don't have serial entrepreneurs are not very common, and you especially do not have serial, there's no real word for it, but you don't have people exiting startups with money and then going on to found other startups.
To fund or found.
In the Valley, other places, people leave Google, right? Leave Facebook, all this kind of stuff. So Facebook goes public, Google goes public, Microsoft, millionaires. A huge number of early stage people, early employees, have a lot of money. They weren't even the founders, right? So, the, you know, equity and stock options and so on that drives the Valley in a lot of ways, I think in ways people don't appreciate, are almost non-existent here. You know, for two reasons. One, it's very, the founders are very small, management are very reluctant to share anything with anybody. You know, companies go public with 5% option pools. In the US, it's 25, 35, whatever. And the employees don't value it. Well, they don't value it because they don't know anybody ever made any money. Literally, I don't think one of our employees or anybody's employees, who do you know that worked for a big company or any company, became famous, went public, whatever, and walked out with millions of dollars? And nobody can name any of these things. In the Valley, everybody knows lots of people like that. So, but without that, you don't have the motivation, you don't have the value. And the Chinese culture also tends to be very, how much money can I get today? And if they haven't seen other people do this, they have seen people do it in real estate, which is why they all buy real estate, because they know a lot of people got rich in real estate. There isn't that culture of, hey, getting options, you know, the concept of working for free for like a year on your startup, did you give me equity? Non-existent, almost unheard of. Yeah, person and just the whole ecosystem and investors should be, if I was an investor here as a VC or whatever, yeah, I'd be much more insistent on spreading the love around. And because if you don't have, because the founder's one thing, and I still, you don't nearly have the serial entrepreneurs and founders leaving and coming starting a second, third, fourth startups here. It happens, but it's very rare. And that's okay, but you need the next 20, 30, 40 people who now have $1 million in the bank or 2 million or whatever to go out and start their own startup. Hey, I've been, you know, mid-level guy at Baidu. Now I want to go out and start my own thing. I want to go out and do this. Sort of the whole, even the PayPal mafia kind of group, right? Look at all the things that come out of that. That stuff doesn't happen here at all. And it's really hard to build a big, successful, vibrant culture because you need all these guys trying all this stuff and failing and losing money. And I think that's a really underappreciated dynamic that you don't see, right? I mean, you see it in Israel, you see it a little bit in Europe, a little bit in New York, in the Valley, a little bit in Seattle, but you don't see much of that here. So I think that's a huge difference. It really, really hurts China in a lot of ways. But beyond that, you see, you know, you don't have the events, you don't have sort of the cross connections and networking. You have a little more in Beijing, I think, but
you
still
between
anybody, just anybody, right? I mean, a friend of mine used to run, or still runs, the sort of master event list for Silicon Valley called Workit, workit.com. And it was very interesting to watch her list. It publishes all the events, all these sort of networking stuff, and to watch it during the bubble, after the bubble, all this kind of stuff, because it is the pulse of things in a lot of ways. And the type of events was great because dot-com bubble, it's all about making money, going IPO, right? In 2001 and 2, it's all about surviving the downturn and selling your IP and all this kind of stuff. but if you go look at the stats, it's hundreds and hundreds of events per week, dozens per night in every different area. You're in biotech, there's only 40 events a week, you know. Even in Beijing, you struggle to get one.
Right.
You know, Mobile Monday, you get a couple of things. And so for a place that is the world's largest internet and billions of dollars are being spent, you can count on one hand the actual useful things that happen in a week or a month. And that makes it really hard to cross-fertilize, to cross-connect, to share ideas, to get together, to go out for drinks. Everybody kind of does their own thing, makes money and kind of launches. And I think that's another missing ingredient here in terms of making a really vibrant, you know, sort of multi-thousand startup, you know, really vibrant culture. So what you end up with are just lots of smaller items, and some of them get very large, of course, and go light in the box, just went public, you know, Chunar, Alibaba, a lot of these guys. Still relatively low numbers, number of companies, even though they have a lot of money. So it's a very different culture, and companies grow quickly here. There's not a lot of mid-size. You kind of grow or die. I don't know. It's an interesting market.
So you would tell startups to still really focus on, or at least looking to Silicon Valley for some inspiration.
If you were there, yeah, certainly, yeah, I think for that, yeah, I think it depends what you're doing, but if I was doing anything else, I'd be doing startups in the Valley or be in the Valley. It's more than the whole rest of the world combined by an order of magnitude, in my opinion. Many will disagree. but also it depends what you're doing too, because you know places like China, for example, online games.
Right.
China dwarfs the world, right? Now the U.S. is finally beginning to catch up, especially with mobile stuff. But the whole thing of how to monetize free games, you know, the Chinese have forgotten more than the Americans will ever learn about this. You know, because there's just massive billions of dollars spent here on online games and merchandise, and all for free games. You know, and so how to do that and the sophistication and all that is something that absolutely is innovative here and not in the U.S. I mean, Microsoft and EA and all these guys trying to do some of this, but nothing like what goes on in China. So it depends where, right? Mobile payments, logistics, all this kind of stuff. There's all kinds of really interesting things happening here that are different than the rest of the world because of the dynamics that are here on the ground. Video went out to Tudou. You know, Tudou had you know, services and features and functions way, way before YouTube ever had in terms of playlists and recommendation engines and all that. We still don't have that stuff because it wasn't important because, again, they're showing pictures of your cat. You know, well, people like Tudou were really broadcast engines and recommendation engines and social networks wrapped up in video. So far, far more innovative than the Western side ever could be, partially for copyright law and lots of other things. And so in many ways, that unlocked a lot of creativity here because, you know, in China, the U.S. is beginning to get like this, but people here never watch television. Never, ever. You know, and the idea of sitting, go home on a Tuesday night, every Tuesday night to watch Sex and the City or Friends, completely non-existent here by anybody who's under 40-something years old. It's when I want, where I want, anytime, any device. And it's been that way since as long as I've been here. The U.S. is not even close to that, even in teenagers. You know, and so if you're in that area and doing all these sexy stuff, the reality is a lot of money in the States. But if you're anywhere in any of that kind of stuff, you know, there's so much going on here in all that, trying to monetize video and all these things. Slowed down recently, but so I think it matters in that sense too. What you're trying to, likewise, you're trying to do, you know, finance things. There's different places and times to try things, so it really matters what you're doing. So it's very exciting on all sides. I think it matters, but still, to me, the Valley is still the place to be for for true core stuff, but there's still a lot of other exciting things that, that pique your interest elsewhere. You know, and you can do big things here because it's extremely competitive there, competitive here too.
So one last question I have for you. If you just could give some parting advice to an aspiring entrepreneur, regardless of whether you're in Silicon Valley or here, you know, what is one thing you wish you had known while starting out, starting your own company? Or if you want to share like your favorite anecdote, what would you say?
So what I tell people a lot is usually the question is, for a lot of people, is should I be an entrepreneur or should I go out and start on my own? You see that here, you certainly see in the Valley, other places, you know, I have a job or and certainly if you have a family and more responsibilities, and should I become an entrepreneur at all? Mm-hmm. Is it really worth it? Is it?
How do I know if I'm any good?
You know, if I don't dare, and again, especially if you have a family, whatever, I don't have any money, whatever. And fear of failure, both certainly loss of face type things, but also just, you know, economic and whatever. And again, I think that's all hogwash. And this, I feel like the fear is real. I am very much the sort of Nike thing, just do it, right? If you think it's for you. Now, some people are very conservative and risk averse and have, you know, want a very steady paycheck and are not good under pressure and don't handle stress very well. Startups are not for you, clearly, right? But if you think you want to do it and see the thing, it's that classic, when you get to the end of your life or whatever, you'll regret the things you didn't do, much more than the ones you did. And if you have any inkling that you want to run your own company and do your stuff, do it. Because you will surely regret not doing it. And especially if you're young and before you're married and those sort of things, it's much harder later, right? And it's harder for women later, particularly, as they become family and so on. So absolutely do it and get out there and try it. If you fail, and this is one of the great Valley culture things, it doesn't matter. Right? And, you know, failure is valuable. And many of the best things have come after many, many, many failures. And sure, it's hard in various things, but what's the worst thing that can happen? You're homeless on the street and have no money, but I live in a soup kitchen. But reality, the worst thing that happens is nothing. Because if you're in the tech world, somebody will snap you up for your experience, your technology, your whatever, as long as you don't completely screw it all up. And even if you do, it doesn't really matter. And the experience and the expertise and the just the overall pride of having done it, even in the worst case, and it really is the worst case, right? Usually it gets better than that. And just do it, you know. And obviously finding the right partners and finding the right niche for you and meeting the right people and then being very flexible and all the things that everybody tells you as advice makes sense. But usually the hardest part is the first step. And after that,
don't overthink it, just do it.
I think overthink, maybe planning and that kind of, don't overthink the should I do it or not, absolutely. I think the more planning and organization you put into it, whatever it is, you know, that of course makes sense. Although these days, you know, we're firing startups and other incubators and sort of in many industries, low cost 3D printers, all this kind of stuff, you know, mobile phones, all stuff, the ability to do really exciting things really cheaply has really opened up a whole world. So it's even easier to do it than it was, you know, 25 years ago when you had to build equipment and buy factories and all this kind of stuff. And certain industries still require that, certainly, biotech and things. but it's even easier to build your own airplanes, to build your own rockets, do your own, I'm not sure you can build your own pharmaceuticals, but you know, all these things is just get out there and just do it, just start something. You know, and I grew up in an entrepreneurial family, so I've never, the idea of working for another company to me has always been sort of alien. But I think just do it, get out there, start tomorrow. Do the best you can, and you will always regret it if you don't do it.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much for your words of wisdom.
Hope you've enjoyed this episode of China Business Cast. Head over to chinabusinesscast.com and enter your email to get on the list. I'll announce guests before I interview them, and you'll get a chance to submit your question for the show. Till next time, thank you for listening.